Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about Black America, and we have been talking about the time when Black America was about to be liberated, or when the calling came that the time had come for slavery to be phased out of the land. And we spoke previously about how there was a certain debt that black people who had been brought to America had to pay because of things that were going on in the black African culture that needed to be dealt with. And because of that, that debt required a payment, and that payment took the form of slavery. And but just like with every other debt, the time comes when the year of Jubilee, figuratively speaking, comes, and then you are given a brand new start once you have done your time, so to speak. And we have shared that the beginning of that redemption from the imprisonment of slavery that was needed because of things that we've already discussed before, that happened when the state, the colony of Georgia was established here in America. And we shared that it was set up in 1732 by a member of parliament in England called James Oglethorpe. And his intention was to provide a place of opportunity to people who had been living in debt. He had seen the horrors of things going on in debtors' prisons, and he believed that the worthy poor, the worthy amongst those who had been trapped in indebtedness, needed to be enabled and helped in some way. And Georgia, this land in the new world, was what he envisioned as a way to help people like that to have a second chance. And his vision was to have a Georgia full of small independent farmers, people who are able, who are given a piece of land and are able to develop it and prosper economically as a result, independently without being attached to the bondage of indebtedness, because in a sense, indebtedness is slavery, is a form of slavery. So he envisioned this colony of Georgia like that, and because of that, he was completely against slavery. He believed that that undermined everything that that Georgia was supposed to be. And therefore, he helped to have slavery officially abolished in this new colony that was assigned to, for him to handle with a board of trustees in 1735. So that's when, even I'm not sure if there was actually any slavery between, say, 1732, when the charter of the colony of Georgia was given to him, or the province of Georgia, and that in 1735, the time when slavery was officially abolished, I would dare say that in those 3 short years, there wouldn't have been enough time for slavery to take hold in any way. So, for all intents and purposes, Georgia was from the very beginning slave free, and but unfortunately, it didn't stay that way. And it was meant to be the entry point of freedom, that gradual process that was going to take place from 1732 up until 1776, in the when the Declaration of Independence was made. And then there might have been a final phase out up until 1788, or 87, 88, when we had the Constitutional Convention and then the ratification of the US Constitution. So there was this 44 to to 52-year period that America had to go through to phase out slavery and then live out the fullness of its calling as a land of freedom, of a true land of freedom for all. And what happened was that even though slavery was not present in the southernmost colony, mind you, slavery was concentrated in the south. There was slavery in the north as well, but it was quickly abolished. In part because the northern economies did not depend on slavery, so there wasn't as much resistance as there was in the south, where the climate was different, it was warmer, and it was more of an agrarian economy with large plantations and so forth, and where it became much more dependent on slavery than the North was. So the North started abolishing slavery one state after another, but the South remained strongly entrenched in slavery. So the fact that the southernmost state was a free state was a very important thing. It was a way of sandwiching the South between freedom, to kind of create a freedom sandwich on the South. And create the moral and moral and social pressure, if you can call it that, to have slavery terminated. But what happened was that Georgia was going along without slavery, but it wasn't because it was mostly made up of smaller farms. The issues of economies of scale and so forth were not present there. So at least on the surface, it looked like Georgia was not prospering as much as other southern states with similar climate. So what happened was, to understand what happened, let's go back a little bit to when the colony was founded. Oglethorpe wanted a Christian influence on Georgia as part of this divine calling that he felt was upon the land of Georgia. And because of that, he invited John Wesley to preach in Georgia. And John Wesley, as some of you may know, was, you could say, the founder of what we now call the Methodist Church. And so he came over, and his experience in Georgia was not good at all. It's kind of a long story that falls out of the scope of this audio clip. But suffice it to say that he was here for a while in Georgia, and eventually America, in a sense, rejected him, and he had to go back to England. But in England, he had established friendship with other Christian believers while he was in Oxford, if I'm not mistaken, studying. And they formed this club, and I think it was derisively called the Holy Club or something to that effect. And it was these committed Christians who would get together to fast, pray, study the Bible, and so forth. And one of the other members of this Holy Club, if that was the name of it, or the name given to it, was a man called by the name of George Whitfield. So George Whitfield and John Wesley were kind of interlinked. And they ended up being in Bristol together, in Bristol, England, and they were preaching there. And George Whitfield, apparently by invitation of Oglethorpe, if I'm not mistaken, came to Georgia to, in a sense, replace Wesley. So he left Wesley in Bristol, kind of preaching to the crowds that he was preaching to. So while John Wesley, in a sense, took his place in England, George Whitefield came to take John Wesley's place, quote unquote, in America, in Georgia. So he came to Georgia, and he felt the need to establish this orphanage. He saw some orphans, and he said, "We need to establish an orphanage," and that orphanage became his obsession. And he came to preach, and as he was focusing on this orphanage, he began to tour the rest of the colonies, the rest of America, to go preach. And in a way, through that touring of preaching, also raise funds for this orphanage. And as he began to preach, he became one of the main forces behind what is called historically as the Great Awakening of 1740. I believe he came around 1738. So 2 years later, this Great Awakening happened in America, spiritually, people desiring to know God and study the Bible and grow spiritually. So as this was happening in great part through the preaching of George Whitefield, who was known to be a very passionate speaker. So he would be very emotional and very enthralling, the type of person that you would listen to and be glued to because of how charismatic and emotionally powerful his sermons were, which was apparently a bit unusual for the time. And the thing is that as he went on, he became very popular. He would draw large crowds because they wanted to listen to this man. And his preaching, his words became very influential in America. And but the thing is that as time went on, he came to the conclusion that the orphanage, which he was trying to raise funds for all the time, was not being well funded because the Georgia economy would not lend itself to support the orphanage, and it wasn't doing so because it didn't have slavery. In other words, he was so obsessed with this orphanage that he believed that for the orphanage to prosper, Georgia had to prosper economically, and for Georgia to prosper economically, it needed to have slaves. So he was willing, in his mind and heart, to have the entire colony of Georgia become subject to the bondage of slavery so that there would be enough money to maintain and keep running, keep the orphanage running. So he began to campaign strongly in Georgia, advocating for the introduction of slavery. Remember, this was a preacher, a Christian preacher that people listened to, and he had great influence. If he said one thing, it would sway hearts one way. If he said something else, it would sway the hearts of people the other way. So he started using his influence to enable slavery. And ironically, it was kind of a mixture of good and bad, because on the one hand, he was one of the first white preachers to actively preach to black people in America. And black people were very receptive to him. And I think in part it's because they could identify with that emotional side of him that appealed to the visionary component that we have described in black people. So even though he was white, we could argue that in a sense he was, he sounded more like a black Pentecostal preacher, so to speak, that he did Lutheran priest. And because of that, he appealed to black people a great deal, and black people loved to listen to him. And he also spoke out against the cruelty of slavery, and he would issue letters and make comments about how awful it was for white slave owners to treat their pets with so much love and affection and consideration, and then turn around and treat the black slaves that they owned so harshly and so inhumanely. So he spoke out against that. So you have this kind of dichotomy of a man who is speaking out against the cruelties of slavery, and also treating black people with respect, in the sense that he would go preach to them. He wouldn't shy away from preaching to black people, meaning that he was aware of the humanity and the value of black people. But at the same time, he was advocating slavery because it served the interests of one of his pet projects. So ironically, the man who criticized other white slave owners for treating their pets better than the slaves was the same person who was treating his pet project better than the black men and women that would make an effort to listen to him. So he treated that pet project, his orphanage, better than he did black America. And because of his strong influence, along with another person whose name I don't recall right now, these two people who were very influential in Georgia ended up convincing Georgia, the trustees and everybody, to accept slavery. So slavery became officially legalized in slavery in Georgia in 1751. So that means that the 19-year project from 1732 to 1751 was over in 19 years before reaching 20, the age of 20. Slavery had made it, freedom had ended, and slavery had made its way into Georgia. And that was, in a sense, the end of it. Because once Georgia accepted slavery, then the possibilities of slavery being eradicated promptly within the divine time schedule was destroyed. So that's kind of what happened with Georgia. And ironically, also, it's worth noting that Whitfield owned slaves. He himself owned slaves. And apparently the slaves that he had, you know, liked him and appreciated him. But he still owned slaves, which kind of goes against the point that it was a divine call or ordinance that slavery had to be phased out, and this Georgia place was the perfect spot for it. And that's why it's fitting that when Sherman, during the American Civil War, as the war was ending, and it ended because of Sherman, Sherman decided to do this scorched earth strategy throughout the South. He wanted to humiliate the South and punish them, but with compassion. I mean, if you read his letters and things like that that he wrote, General Sherman was not this crazy, bloodthirsty monster. He knew what he was doing, and he was doing it with control. He was doing it knowing exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it, to achieve a certain purpose and to execute the necessary punishment that needed to be executed so that there'd be restoration and an end to the war. And while as he did that, he went into Georgia. And Georgia was the state that he did the most damage in. And that's why they talk about Sherman's march through Georgia. Of all the states in the South, that's the one that he kind of hit the hardest. And it's fitting because Georgia was supposed to be the place from which slavery would have been abolished, and which would have meant that there would have been no need for the Civil War to happen. So it's fitting that Georgia was hit so hard and that was the beginning of the end of the Civil War. It's as if the Civil War could not end until Georgia got scorched and hit with this terrible punishment. It was until then that the debt had been paid in a sense by the South to a certain extent, and the Civil War could come to an end. And it's also interesting that I've always believed this in my heart, even before having a better understanding about the historical roots of Georgia. I had never known that Georgia was once a free state. I mean, I think the vast majority of Americans don't know that, which is so sad. It says a lot about our education system and about a lot of other things, but even before I understood this, I had always felt that there was something about the state of Georgia and black people. I would hear about, how Atlanta seemed to be. Atlanta is, I guess, in a sense, a black city, mostly black city, but it's black in a different way. I know it has violence and other problems that are always associated with places where there's a lot of black people. But aside from that, I was also aware, even from a young age, that Atlanta seemed to be this place, unusual place, where black people seem to have the ability to prosper economically and socially in a way that they would not normally do in other places. And for example, I could be wrong with this, but I believe Tyler Perry is from Georgia, or at least his. A lot of his production work is from Georgia. Tyler Perry's this like TV producer. He produces a lot of television shows and so forth. And there are examples like that of people coming out, black people coming out of Georgia who seem to be successful. The current Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is from Georgia. He's the only black judge sitting in the Supreme Court of the United States at the time of this recording, and he is from the state of Georgia. And also, Martin Luther King was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's fitting that a man from Georgia was the one who kind of led the final assault against the oppression of the South against black people. Because Georgia always had this calling of freedom and liberation for Black America. It's as if, and that's why a lot of prosperity of Black people is in Georgia, because Georgia was going to be, had this kind of calling or impartation of prosperity and freedom for Black people. And, but unfortunately, this man, Whitfield, was more concerned about his orphanage and his ministerial work than about understanding the divine plan, what was supposed to happen in Georgia and his role in it. Because if he had spoken out against slavery, going around preaching all over the U.S., well, it was not the U.S. officially at the time, but let's call it the U.S., the future U.S. He was preaching throughout the future U.S. and drawing large crowds and getting people to react emotionally in a profound way to his words. People were not just listening and giving mental assent to what he was saying. They were, broken emotionally, broken down by the things that this man was saying. That's how powerful his preaching was. And as he was doing that, can you imagine what would have happened if he had decided to talk about the evils of slavery and put it from a Christian perspective and say, saying God is saying this, that you, America, are sinning against God for doing this. Can you imagine the impact that would have had as he would have traveled throughout the South and into the North? It would have created, and remember, he was part of the Great Awakening of 1740, And he had a strong influence on America way past 1740. I think he made like 13 trips across the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, in the sense of crossing the Atlantic Ocean 13 times. And so that means that he came at least 7 times. And he left England 6 different times. So it's not an even number because he died in America. I mean, he was an Englishman, but his influence, a lot of it, his work was here in America. And he spent a vast amount of his life and ministerial life in the colonies, to the point that he ended up dying here, not in England. And if he had been willing to become the vessel against slavery in Georgia and throughout the colonies, the moral conscience of the country, and I mean country in a figurative sense, because it was not the U.S. yet, it was still colonies, but it was a country, you know, conceptually speaking. He would have stirred the moral conscience of the entire country to the point that people would have said, no, we have to end this. There's no way we can continue with this. And he would, if he had been listening and understanding what needed to be said, he would have been able to also verbalize what we said in these audio clips, that slavery was a necessary part of the process for the redemption of black people, that they needed to be put through this punishment, this prison sentence, to pay a debt because of the issues that we've described before, the issue of that selfishness and that cannibalism that that the black race seemed to be constantly exhibiting. And if he had been able to say that, in other words, so that the people in the South would have understood, okay, we had a role in running this prison for a purpose. That would have kind of also kind of not validated their actions, but kind of given them an understanding of why they had been put in this position. But then also being told, okay, you were the prison wardens for a while, but now the sentence is up. And now you have to let the prisoners go, and then it would have put everything in perspective, and it would have helped into the healing process. And yes, you have to understand also that there were economic consequences for the people in the South who owned slaves, who had put their money into slavery, into the slavery trade. And, you know, like people put money into Wall Street and the stock market. If you then turn around, say, stocks don't have any value anymore, then you know you're going to cause chaos. But if we as a people had this moral conscience about how slavery had to end, and it had to end soon, there was a time table, and it had to be kind of beginning to be phased out by 1776 and then completely gone by 1788 when the Constitution came up, then we would have come up with a plan on how to slowly maybe do some sort of turning the slaves into employees, where the employee had to somehow compensate the slave owner through his work. He was now free, but he needed to compensate the slave owner for a portion of what he had put into the slave, into buying the slave. And it would have and something would have been worked out, and so to the point that slaves, black people would have been turned from slaves to employees, in a way that would not have been too harmful or too drastic to slave owners. It would have been workable, and then after a generation or two, then black people would be completely free from all obligations of any sort. But it wasn't done, and that's why we are where we are now. So that's how we ended up with the situation of slavery that resulted in the Civil War. But before continuing with that topic, I think it would be important to also have a sense of how slavery was opposed by a lot of people in America. Because there's this general sense, especially promoted by the liberal left, that America was, okay with slavery. Like, all white people are racist, so every white person in America was okay with slavery. But and especially Christians, because to the left, liberal Christians are evil, and white Christian is like double evil, like vampire evil, vampire combined with zombie or something like that. And but it wasn't quite like that, and that's why. And it's important to say that, because if Whitfield and others had understood what needed to be done and just turned up the switch, turned up the fire, fire, it would have turned into a massive blaze that would have led to freedom. Because there was enough combustible material there to start a big fire. It's just that no one tried to light the spark. So to understand that there was enough enough potential support for the end of slavery, we have to consider, I believe, some of the founding fathers who opposed slavery, because the left liberal is always talking about the founding fathers as all being white chauvinist, racists, and fascists, and so forth. And as you know, if you've listened to these audio clips, we're very critical of the founding fathers. They did a lot of stupid things, and the people who worship the founding fathers are idiots and idolaters, and are the main reason why we are where we are, because they are the ones who are not affecting the change that needs to be done to stop the lunacy of the left. But even though we say that about the founding fathers, it does not take away from many of their good qualities, and that there were decent people in the group. It's just that they just collectively did a lot of stupid things in terms of not doing things right, and being stubborn about not doing things right. And we are idiots in America for stubbornly clinging to what they stubbornly clung to, convinced that they were doing the right thing just because they were the founding fathers. But the thing is, there were founding fathers that opposed slavery. And I got this list from an article on, I think the website is thehill.com. I'm not sure if it's a left-leaning or right-leaning website. I wasn't too clear on that, but I guess it doesn't matter. At least when it comes to this list, and it seems like most of what they said was factual and valid. I didn't see a lot of bias either way, so I'm going to share the list of the founding fathers who opposed slavery according to this website. The first person they listed was John Adams. John Adams was the second president of the United States. He was the one who followed Washington, and he was one of the founding fathers. Interestingly enough, out of the 12 presidents, the first 12 presidents America had, he's only one of two who did not own slaves at any time in his life, which is kind of a sad statement to make. You know, 12 presidents, and that covered a whole bunch of time. That would, if I'm not mistaken, that would take us into 1850, more or less. Up until 1850, when the 12 president died, we had, you know, one slave owning president after the other, or at least a president that owned slaves at some point in his life, and except for two, and they were one was this second president, John Adams, and the other one, interestingly enough, was his son, John Quincy Adams, who was the sixth president of the United States, and they were the only two who can, out of the first 12, who can say they never owned slaves in their lifetimes. And but there's one special case that is worth mentioning. Martin Van Buren, the eighth president of the United States, he did own a slave, but it was because his father, if I'm not mistaken, owned like six slaves or something like that. And one of those, and he was given one slave. His name was Tom, so he technically owned the slave, but he wasn't too fond of the whole slave thing. So apparently the slave escaped, and he made no effort whatsoever to you know, get him back. And it sounds like he, you know, just figuratively speaking, it's as if he left the door open and turned his back and just let the slave go out the door, and then he turned around and said, "Whoops, he's gone. Oh my goodness, what shall I do?" But apparently he kind of let him go on purpose, in a sense, and to the point that someone offered to capture him and give him back to Martin Van Buren, and Martin Van Buren gave some very tough conditions to the guy who was offering to help catch him, because apparently he knew where he was. But Martin Van Buren really didn't want Tom back as a slave. So he gave him very tough conditions upon which he would receive Tom back or buy him back. And the guy said, "Okay, in that case, it's not worth it." So he didn't try to capture Tom, and Tom apparently lived a free man until the end. And Martin Van Buren was opposed to slavery. He became so opposed to the point that he was part of the Free Soil Party. There was a party called the Free Soil Party. Before the Republican Party came about, I think in 1848, he was campaigning for that party, and it was a party based. Its main platform was anti-slavery, so it was an abolitionist party, and he spoke openly, fervently against slavery. So even though he did own a slave that maybe he inherited from his father, I don't know how he got the slave unwillingly, he's not on the list of the two that never owned slaves, but you could say that for all intents and purposes he was not a real slave owner. So he's kind of a special case. But with the other nine out of the first 12, yes, most of them willingly owned slaves. Coming back to John Adams, John Adams decried the institution of slavery as a, quote, "foul contagion in the human character," and as, quote, "an evil of colossal magnitude." And he said that the American Revolution would never be complete until all slaves were free. Remember, so notice, he knew, he perceived it. The American Revolution will not be complete until all slaves are free. It's like he knew that divine mandate that between 1732 and 1776, America had been given the time to phase out slavery. And I believe that something would have happened in 1776, and then there would have been like a final phase out between 1776 and 1788 to complete the liberation of all black people in America. He understood it, and he said it. I'm not a big fan of John Adams for reasons that go outside the scope of this audio clip, but it's interesting and noteworthy that he had this attitude. But this is part of why I don't like him. This is not the only reason, but he was just like this. Notice the strong language he used against slavery. And remember, this is back in the at the beginning, late 1700s, early 1800s. So we're not talking about some liberal talking in the 20th century. We're talking about people way back. They understood the evil of it, and they spoke it out, openly. And but even so, he was against abolitionists. In other words, he didn't like abolitionists because they seemed to be like demanding immediate liberation and okay, let's let all the slaves be free, and he didn't like that because that seemed like too much turmoil, like too much too soon kind of thing. So he was against abolitionists, and he advocated for a gradual approach, even though he would tell abolitionists, "I don't agree with you, but I wish you luck anyway." In other words, if what you plan to do works out, I'll be with you. I'll support you. But if it doesn't work out, I'm against you because I think you're trying to push it too hard. So there's this half-heartedness or double-mindedness. Instead of saying, okay, well, what's the gradual approach? Okay, you want a gradual approach. What is it? What's the plan? What's the plan, Stan? And he never came up with it because it's as if he was hoping for the emancipation to drop from the sky. Like, oh, if you guys make it happen, like if you do it, awesome. But I'm not going to lay out a plan or say we need to do this, 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 and this. He would just, do the rhetoric. And I believe he was sincere in the rhetoric, but what's the point of the rhetoric if you're not going to then carry it out and provide something specific? So that was number one, John Adams. Another guy who was not, he was more English than American, but he was very influential in America, and this guy is Thomas Paine, the guy who wrote the pamphlet called Common Sense that was what kind of stirred the flames of revolution in America. There might not have been an American Revolution without Thomas Paine and the Common Sense pamphlet. That's how important he was. But he was probably one of the more kind of direct enemies of slavery, not like John Adams, who was kind of a little bit wishy-washy. He used his reputation because he became very popular in the American colonies because of that pamphlet and other stuff he wrote. He used that reputation to constantly advocate against slavery. So he had sort of a sway, not quite like, but kind of similar in some way to George Whitefield. But George Whitefield used that reputation, that sway that he had for the opposite purpose. And it's a shame, but this guy who had less of a sway on the moral fiber of America used it to constantly advocate against slavery. He called it an execrable commerce, and he also called it a, quote, outrage against humanity and justice. Outrage against humanity and justice. Imagine that. So these are strong words. And he also actively spoke out against slavery in Britain, and he was important in the passing of the Abolitionist Slave Act in England. So he had an influence in America and in England, fighting against slavery. And another founding father, even though he's not like American either. Is Marquis de Lafayette, a person that I've always admired, even ever since I was a kid. I don't know why Lafayette was this. There was something special about the guy, even though as a kid I had no idea what he did really, other than know that he was famous in history. I knew there was something special about him, and now that I've learned a little bit more about him, I understand why. He was born in France, and he heard of what was happening in America, and he came. He was a general, or you know, something in the army in France. He saw the American struggle, and he said, "I'm going over there to help those guys out." It's not like he was a mercenary, a Hessian mercenary coming over, you know, getting paid in gold to fight for the Americans. He decided on his own, "Oh, I want to go help guys," and he came all the way over. Remember, he didn't have, take a plane and land in 7 hours here in America. He had to take a boat, travel for many weeks all the way over to America across the Atlantic Ocean, and be in a completely different place, in a new world where everything was different, still developing, leaving the developed world that he knew and loved, coming over here, sacrificing himself, fighting for the Americans, for people that were not, they were not French. It's not like he was coming to fight for French Canadians. It was English-speaking Americans. He was coming here to, he came all the way over, and he fought bravely, and he was a great reason why America won the Revolutionary War. And so this man, out of his own funds, personal funds, he purchased a plantation in the French colony of Cayenne with the intention of freeing slaves through gradual manumission. So, and Cayenne is what's now French Guyana, which is in South America. So this was not happening in America proper, but we're sharing this just to give you an idea of how committed he was to fighting, to helping black people be free. So Cayenne is French Guyana, which is like right on the top edge of South America. If you look at the top edge of South America, you have Colombia, you're going from west to east, Colombia, Venezuela, then you have Guyana, you know, and then you have, if I'm not mistaken, you have Suriname, and then you have French Guyana. I could have that order incorrect, but more or less that's the order. And those are those three little countries, Guyana, Suriname, and French Guyana. Guyana, in a sense, is the British Guyana. They speak English there. It's the only country in South America whose official language is English. Then you have Suriname, which was the Dutch colony. It's like the Dutch Guyana. And then you have French Guyana, which is, as the name says it, the French Guyana. That's where the French had their colony in South America. Well, so there he wanted to buy, he purchased a plantation with his own money, mind you, with the intent of freeing the slaves. So he was, you know, doing gradual manumission, you know, slowly setting them free, like buying them to set them free. And he also appealed to King Louis the 16th to support you know, the endeavor of freeing slaves and become an inspiration to other abolitionists through his words and his deeds. So he wanted Louis the 16th to kind of take a role of speaking out against slavery to help people be free. And Frederick Douglass, who I believe is one of the two greatest black Americans in American history. Maybe one day we'll do an audio clip on what I believe are the 10 greatest Americans of all time. And sadly, that list of 10 only has 9. And there's a reason for that. But we may someday talk about that. But the thing is that Frederick Douglass, who, if you do not know him, he was a slave back in the 1800s. He was born in near Baltimore in Maryland, he kind of grew up there, and he was able to escape and become free. And he became this self-educated black man who became a great orator, and he spoke eloquently. He even traveled to England, and he became this giant of a man. He proved that that you don't have to live with this victim mentality. He had every reason to live in the victim mentality, full of bitterness against the white man. And he had reasons to be bitter against the white man, not like black people of today, who have this bitterness that is just indoctrinated into their thinking, not because of real things that are happening in their lives, because a lot of the things that are happening in their lives are self-induced. But this man really had a legitimate reason to be resentful and bitter and feel like a victim. He did none of that. And against all odds, he educated himself, and he also believed that he was an American. He never saw himself as a Negro, a black man, who happens to live in America. He never would have never thought of himself as an African American. He rejected the notion that the solution to the black problem was to send black people back to Africa, because he said, "I'm not African. I have nothing to do with Africa. My home is here." So he felt like an American, and he was an American. And this Frederick Douglass praised Lafayette's efforts, and he wrote that he considered Lafayette to be a, quote, a true abolitionist and one of the few men of the time who embraced racial equality. That's how much he praised Lafayette, even though, obviously they didn't live in the same time period, or the same exact time period. But he praised him a lot. So there another founding father worth mentioning is Roger Sherman. And Roger Sherman is not that well known, but he is the only founding father to have signed all four of America's founding documents. He signed the Articles of Association, which are not that well known, to our collective American shame. The Articles of Association, also called the Continental Association, was an agreement that was signed by the first Continental Congress on the 20th of October, 1774. That's 2 years before 1776, or one and a half, yeah, almost 2 years, calling for a trade boycott against British merchants. So it was like the first collective official big agreement by the colonies to align themselves against Britain. And this Articles of Association was calling for a trade boycott against British merchants. So that was like the first act of rebellion and sign of American union against the British. So he signed that document. He also signed the Articles of Confederation, which was the prelude or the prequel to the US Constitution that we have at the time of this recording. And so he signed that too. And then he signed the Constitution itself. And he also signed the Declaration of Independence. So all those are considered the four founding documents of the country. And all four have a lot of flaws, even the Declaration of Independence. But regardless, he signed all four. But this guy also had his flaws. He was the one who proposed the bicameral system to end the deadlock during the Constitutional Convention. So in 1787, when they were, drafting the Constitutional Convention, there was a big conflict because some wanted the states to have better representation or the states to assert their state rights, and others wanted a more democratic system. So he proposed what was called the Great Compromise, where he said, "Okay, let's have a bit of both. Let's have the House of Representatives that will be more democratic based on population, and then we'll have the Senate where each state will have two representatives. So that way, state rights are promoted. And everybody's, oh, okay, that's great, let's do that. And as we've explained in other audio snippets, it just created a slew of problems. It introduced elitism. It also helped to perpetuate slavery. So this man who was opposed to slavery, as we will see a little bit later, he instituted one of the institutions. He helped put in place one of the institutions that helped cement slavery in America. And that institution is called the U.S. Senate. Because federalism is at the heart of what helped slavery take hold. Instead of fighting it, instead of saying, no, we can't have a system where the southern states can somehow manipulate things to keep hold of slavery. And if we don't agree, let's not agree. We'd rather just not agree from the get-go than have this compromise and this tenuous union and then have to fight it out at the end. So he contributed to the stagnation that followed by proposing this great compromise. And also during that Constitutional Convention, he opposed a tax on slaves because he felt that that would turn them into property. But that's kind of ironic in a sense. In a sense, you do understand that, yes, okay, that it's like, oh, that sounds like violating the dignity of slaves and say, oh, you're going to put a tax on slaves the way you put a tax on land or some other inanimate object. How dare you? But the irony is that the tax on slaves actually would have been saying, in a sense, a tax is almost like a penalty. And this goes against everything we've said before about the tax system. But you have to understand, if we're not going to play by any rules, then certain things can become valid. But if you put a tax on slaves, that's like putting a tax on cigarettes. What is the tax on cigarettes for? It's to disincentivize people from buying cigarettes because they become more expensive. So if you put a tax on slaves, then you're making the slave trade and slave ownership more expensive. So that means that you're less inclined to own slaves and get into the slave business. So even though it sounded all nice and moral, I don't want the government to tax to put a tax on slaves because that dehumanizes the slave. Well, actually, what he did by doing that is make slavery more affordable for the South. So, and he also compromised with Southern colonies on some provisions protecting slavery because he wanted to keep them in the Union. That was this constant thing. Let's compromise. That's why I just so despise it when politicians say, oh, you don't know how to negotiate and you don't play and you're ideological and you don't compromise and blah, blah, blah. Well, compromise leads to all of this nonsense. And instead of fighting it out from the beginning on principle. But again, the war had been lost the moment that George Whitefield idiotically convinced Georgia to accept slavery. That's when the war was lost in a sense. We were just living out the consequences, the repercussions of that. But even so, no one seemed to be putting up much of a fight. Someone once wrote that Sherman, quote, consistently opposed slavery because he believed all humans were made in the image of God and must be treated with dignity. But again, he did a lot of things that made slavery possible. As we said, as you know, he helped create the Senate. He opposed the taxes on slaves. He did a lot of other compromises with the Southern colonies just to keep them happy during the Constitutional Convention. But he was he saw in black people the image of God, and he said they must be treated with dignity. But again, it was just the words, but they didn't quite follow through. And he didn't, he never owned slaves, so at least he was never double-minded in that bad of a sense. And then the next person we want to quickly talk about is probably one of my favorite, personally, founding fathers. His name is Gouverneur Morris. And he came from a slave-owning family, but he never owned a slave himself. And he's the guy who wrote, many people don't know this, especially Americans, he wrote the preamble to the Constitution, you know, the famous one that I'll just read it here. It says, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." So the "we," every time a conservative says "we the people," they are knowingly or unknowingly quoting Governor Morris, who wrote this preamble to the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, the current one at the time of this recording. And so he's famous for that and other things. And he was an advocate for a strong central government, which means that he was not in favor of this federalism stuff. And he was the only one, I believe, who was consistently opposed to slavery in a straight and direct way, the way it had to be done. He gave what people many call a blazing anti-slavery speech at the convention. So while everybody was talking about all this stuff, while Sherman was trying to placate the South, ironically, isn't that ironic? Sherman, there was a Roger Sherman placating the South, and then eventually there was a William Tecumseh Sherman, the general during the Civil War, who blazed through the South with no compassion whatsoever, until they had to bend the knee and say, "We give up." Unwillingly still, but so while Sherman, this other Sherman was compromising, and everybody, and John Adams was kind of saying one thing and doing another, this guy was in front of the whole convention giving a blazing anti-slavery speech. And Madison, James Madison, characterized Morris's speeches, recognizing that the institution of slavery acted, quote, "in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity," and he said that Morris viewed the, quote, "nefarious practice with," quote, "a laudable horror." So you can see that even back in those days, in the 1780s, there was an awareness of how evil it was, and Governor Morris was one of the people who was saying it openly. So that's another person. Another one, founding father who was opposed to slavery was Alexander Hamilton. He was the founding member of the New York Manumission Society, an organization that was dedicated to the abolishing of slavery in New York. That was his home state. He was a New Yorker, you could say. And he never owned slaves either. And he was active in the passing of the Slave Trade Act of 1800 that was signed into law by John Adams in May of 1800. And and just to get a sense of what the Slave Trade Act was, we'll start kind of saying some things about certain acts that were passed in America related to the reduction, you could say, of slavery. So this Slave Trade Act of 1800 was, you could say, maybe the second act in a series of acts that began to reduce slavery in America, which was part of the process we had to go through from 1732 to 1776, but we were delaying it and not only delaying it, shifting it in time forward, but also prolonging it, making it much longer than it had to be. But it's too much to go through at this point. So we will save it for the next audio snippet. It's important to go through all this somehow tedious, you could say, historical context to get a better sense of what was going on in America, the awareness of what slavery was, and how it was feasible to do what we've been saying, but it just wasn't done. But we need to get that historical sense, look back and understand how slavery was being phased out or attempting to be phased out, so that we can then look back and see exactly what we need to declare as good and bad so that we can then move forward based on that information. Thank you very much for listening.